A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Join the conversation.
You're with Cape Talk.
It's now time for our regular Friday appointment listening with the Naked Scientist. Good morning, Dr. Chris. And how is Cambridge treating you this morning?
Oh, big slip up there. Right, I'm not talking to you. You'll have to find another guest for the next 25 minutes. I'm sorry. That's that. That's done it.
Rivalry.
I'm good. I'm very good, actually. And despite the Oxford reference, I'm in Cambridge. I'm good. Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Obviously, our weather is looking like a English morning out here with grey skies and rainy weather. I hope yours is better in Cambridge.
Well, it's looking very much like a Cape Town day when I visit, because I try and visit when the weather's good at the right time of year. It's glorious. I've been moaning about the weather all year because it's been so cold and we've had more rain than really we should have done. I mean, in some places we've had a year's worth of rain in a matter of months, but all of a sudden it's remembered it's supposed to be approaching summer, so the sun is shining, the temperature's gone up, and the plants have gone, hey, we're actually supposed to be growing. So that beautiful green, that verdant green that comes at this time of year, everything's in leaf now. So it makes you happy to be alive when you see that kind of thing. And you get to make some vitamin D, which I'm chronically short of by the end of winter. I know this because I tested myself and I was amazed. I had such low levels of vitamin D, but that's what comes when you live in high latitudes like this.
Yes, no, I can feel your happiness, Chris. I really can. So I'm really happy for you. So, Dr. Chris, this week we've had a tragic event taking place here in the province, a building collapse. So we actually have a question from a listener that's saying we just interviewed Natalie talking about the people trapped in the rubble. How long can a person remain without food and water and is there a point of no return? Because in this case, Dr. Chris, we're still looking for more than 30 bodies.
It's very tragic and I'm ever so sorry to hear about that and the people who are involved, and also for the people who have to try to help those people, because that can be very traumatic too. The answer is it depends, and it depends on the local environment. Because a person can go without food for a long time, but if they're really hot or they've lost blood or other fluids and they're dehydrated, then they really need water urgently. On the other hand, if the temperature is just right, so it's not too cold and not too hot, and a person has got air to breathe, because that's the critical thing. If you're trapped in an airspace, but you've got adequate ventilation because air can find its way in and out, then you can actually do fine. As long as you're able to sit tight and people can dig you out, you can be fine, and you can be fine for a number of days. But really, it's the water, it's the lack of fluids that will begin to really get to people. Food, we can do without that for an extended period of time. Most of us carry too much weight anyway, so we can actually live off our body fat, literally. But it's the fluids that's the problem, and access to air and cold temperatures. So as long as people are in the right sort of conditions, then actually, as long as everything's stable and people can get to them eventually, there's every reason to be optimistic for several days. It also depends on size, of course. Very, very small people and much older people are at much greater risk because they're more vulnerable because their health is less robust. Healthy adults and older children tend to do much better, and there's every reason to be optimistic for them.
Okay, thanks for that, Dr. Chris. So a question from Sharon. Dr. Chris, can you explain why some of us are more prone to hangovers than others? I can hold my liquor much better than my boyfriend, who really struggles after a big night out and actually drinks less than me. So from very serious issues, Dr. Chris, to a real question of having a hangover.
Well, first of all, what's a hangover? A hangover is because you've poisoned yourself with alcohol, because alcohol is a poison. And the reason it's poisonous is because it gets converted metabolically by enzymes in your liver from alcohol, which makes you drunk and happy and opens up your blood vessels a bit, into another chemical, which is called acetaldehyde. And this is where you break down the alcohol en route to making it into vinegar, which you can pee out. But the acetaldehyde is an inflammatory chemical. And it's about a carbon atom and a few hydrogen atoms different from the stuff that we use to fix and embalm bodies in the post-mortem room. So it's doing that to you internally. And so it goes all around your body and causes inflammation in your tissues. This includes in the tissues of your brain and around your brain, the meninges. It's also, when you drink a lot, very dehydrating because alcohol is a diuretic, so it makes you wee a lot. And when you wee a lot, you lose water from the body in total. And this means you upset your biochemistry, your salt and water balance goes wrong. And alcohol is also irritant to your stomach. It causes the acid in your stomach to attack the lining of the stomach for various reasons. And then you get a sore tummy. And if you're really, really overindulging and you're ill, throw up, then that also upsets your salt and water balance, irritates your stomach. And that also robs you of calories because alcohol inhibits the production of sugars from the liver that can supply your tissues with sugar. So this all adds up to feeling pretty groggy. You haven't got enough energy. Your salt and water balance is all over the place. So you feel like you've had a really bad gut bug. Your tummy's sore because you've irritated it and you've caused inflammation all around your body because of the acetaldehyde. And this is the effect of a hangover. Some people get this worse than others because some people make more of those inflammatory chemicals than others because of quirks of their metabolism. People from the Far East in China tend to have forms of that enzyme that breaks down alcohol and turns it into acetaldehyde and then gets rid of the acetaldehyde. Their enzymes don't work as well at getting rid of the acetaldehyde as people from other countries. So you break down the alcohol, turn it into something nasty, and the something nasty hangs around for longer in that person, and that causes more inflammation and more hangover symptoms. So it's a combination of how big your body is, how much you drink, what you drank, and how quickly, because that makes a difference, what you did to rehabilitate yourself afterwards, and your metabolism underneath all of that that dictates how fast you break down alcohol and how fast you get rid of the breakdown products of alcohol.
Oh, wow. Dr. Chris, now I'm definitely not going to be drinking and I'm supposed to go to a party tonight. But so is there anything that you can do to counter it? Drink lots of water? You know, do you drink orange juice after a binge night or just let the body do its work?
Best thing to do is never drink on an empty stomach. Well, the best thing to do is not to drink to excess anyway. Drink socially, enjoy it, but don't overdo it. That's the doctor's advice. But we all know, doctors are the worst culprits among them, that no one does that. Everyone has the odd occasional slip. So the best thing to do is do not drink on an empty stomach, because the amount of alcohol that's in your stomach, when you've got other things in your stomach, you control how quickly the stomach contents are released into the small intestine where most of the absorption takes place. And if you've got food in your stomach, it slows down how quickly you dispense material into your small intestine, and therefore the alcohol is dispensed into the small intestine and absorbed a bit more slowly, so you don't overwhelm your ability to metabolize it on the way through the liver. So you may not get as drunk as quickly, which should be everyone's aim. But what that does is give your body more time to break things down and break down the nasties so they don't have time to get out and around the rest of the body and cause that inflammation. So do it with food, do it sensibly, space out the drinks and try to keep an eye on hydration. Because if you're drinking an alcoholic drink, try and have a glass of water as your next drink, or something with more water and much less alcohol, or better still, no alcohol, and spread the drinks out. Because that way, you're giving your body time to break down the alcohol. We use the rule of thumb that you break down about 1 unit of alcohol per hour. What's a unit of alcohol? It's about, 1 unit is about 1 glass of wine, and a pint of beer's got about 2 units in it. So you break that down at the rate of 1 unit per hour. Try to spread this out so that you are not a building up a toxic level of alcohol. And if you space your drinking out like that, do it on a full stomach, you will slow down the rate at which it gets into your body, slow down the rate at which you make the nasties, which you can then deal with because you're not overwhelming the system. And the fact that you've kept an eye on your hydration and your salt and water balance, which the food will help with, that should help to mitigate against the risk of having a bad hangover.
Another question from Keith. Does fish and other sea animals need to drink water, even if they are permanently in water?
Yes, they do. So let's think about things that are not fish to start with. So marine mammals like cetaceans, dolphins, whales and so on, they're just like us except they live in the sea. They need to drink. Where do they get their water from? They get some of it from the water that's in the sea, and they're very good at dealing with salt, but most of it comes from their food. So they'll eat fish and things like that, and the body fluids of the fish and the other things, they will contribute to the water in the body of the animal. Fish that are in the water all the time, they have a big problem because they don't breathe like a whale or a dolphin where they've got lungs. They're using gills. And the way gills work, as you've seen at the front end of a fish as it opens and closes those flaps beside its head, water is rushing through the gills, and the gills have a dense network of blood vessels in them which bring the fish's blood very close to the water. And this means that nasties in the blood like carbon dioxide can move out into the water where it's at low concentration, and oxygen, which is in the water at relatively higher concentration, can move into the blood. But it's very hard to keep the water in or out. If you're in a sea environment, it's very salty, much saltier than your body fluids. So the fish is having to fight losing water from its body into the sea. If it's in fresh water, the fish have got the reverse problem because the water in the lake they're in is much more dilute than the fish's body. So the water tries to move into the fish's bloodstream and it would blow up the fish. So these animals regulate their balance of water and salts in their body very, very carefully. And they've got various ways of doing that, which they do with their kidneys and other things, to control where the salts go and how water moves in and out of their body. But they're basically absorbing water through their food, but also largely through water exchange across their gill surfaces.
Dr. Chris, a question from Solly. Can you confirm that gorillas don't drink water? I saw a video online that says they are terrified of water and get all their moisture from their diet. Is this true?
Woo, I don't know. That's a brilliant question, and I have no idea about that. I've never been asked that, and I never thought about it. They do eat things which are quite leafy and therefore going to be quite water rich. So I suspect they do get a huge amount of water from their diet, but I've no idea whether gorillas really do tend to go off and drink regularly. They will have an obligatory water usage or requirement, just like we do, because everyone has what's called insensible losses. We're losing from our body just by breathing a huge amount of water. About half a litre leaves your body every day from your breath. You squirt probably about half a litre of sweat into your shoes every day in just sweaty feet. And you lose a litre or two in what goes down the lavatory from number twos every day. And then you've got urine as well. At least half a litre goes that way. So we're losing enormous amounts of water, a couple of litres a day in water from all these different places. I wouldn't think gorillas are that much different. So they've got to replace that somehow. So probably a lot does come from their diet, but I don't know whether or not they are terrified of water as alleged. If anyone is a gorillaologist and can tell us about this, do phone us up and let us know.
Thank you. Dr. Chris, and there's another fan of yours, that Andrew, who asked please ask Dr. Chris if he was on the Cambridge rowing team.
No, I don't have the kind of physique for that, unfortunately. Perfect face for radio and perfect physique for sitting behind a microphone, but definitely not sitting behind a set of oars. Those guys are amazing. Even the Oxford team are amazing. They are huge, and they get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go for about a 10-mile run before they then hit the river, and they train so hard. The metabolic rates of those guys, when they're at peak performance, when they're pulling down the river, when you watch the Oxford Cambridge boat race, which we saw a month or so ago, the output from those guys, they are burning hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calories an hour doing that. I mean, they're probably at 1,000 calories an hour, that burn rate, and huge energy output that they're producing. You need a seriously fit body and some really, really hefty training, and you need to be dealt a really good genetic hand, because the people who are good at that are really good athletes anyway, and they have the metabolism and the biochemistry to support it. And not everyone is lucky enough to inherit those traits. And interestingly, I was at Queen's College, where I'm a fellow in Cambridge recently, and we were admitting some new fellows, honorary fellows. Some people are made fellows as a mark of respect or recognition because of contributions they make. And I bumped into two ladies who come from New Zealand, and they had rowed for the Cambridge rowing team, ladies team, when they were at the college a few years ago. So it was really nice to meet them, and they won. So they were very proud of their achievements.
Beautiful. Dr. Chris, we've got a caller.
Good morning. Morning, Dr. Chris. So this morning I was reading about why people have vivid dreams, and I saw some mention of eating spicy food before sleeping maybe causing vivid dreams. Is that possible, and why would that be the case?
Oh, good morning. Well, I think this is probably a myth, to be perfectly honest with you. The thoughts or the fear, the theory would go that certain things in certain foods, like monosodium glutamate flavour enhancer, can get into your bloodstream. And because that's one of the excitatory neurotransmitters in the brain, perhaps if you have lots of these things washing around in your bloodstream, this can tickle your brain, and particularly certain brain circuits, and make them more active than normal. Perhaps when you're asleep, that could make you dream more. I am sceptical about this, but with a couple of reservations. I'm sceptical because the brain is such a delicate organ, and it's so tightly regulated. It's got such good control over its biochemistry by a structure which is called the blood-brain barrier, that it's very much shielded from what goes on in your bloodstream. And although that system does open up in order to flush the brain out at night when we go to sleep, and so there's therefore potentially some access from what's going on peripherally in your body to brain tissue, it's still very, very limited and very tightly regulated, for very good reason, because food is full of stuff like glutamate and other chemicals that could tickle your brain and upset the biochemical and neurochemical apple cart. So our bodies go to enormous lengths to keep the brain separate from what's going on. Now, what's the exception to this? Well, there are certain things in food that certainly can get into your brain and certainly can affect brain function. And there are accounts back in history of people eating certain things, and those things can cause changes to the way the brain works. The most classic example, magic mushrooms, for example, they work because they make chemicals which get across the blood-brain barrier and change the signalling between certain populations of nerve cells. And that's why people have hallucinogenic experiences and so on. There are chemicals like magic mushrooms that are produced by magic mushrooms that are produced by other moulds. And so there is also the claim that some foods which haven't been stored properly or may have mould growing on them may have chemicals in them that can do something a bit similar to this. So it might be that certain foodstuffs will trigger trips in some people or affect dreams. The classic one people talk about is cheese, because cheese is stuffed full of amines, chemicals that are quite similar to the nerve transmitters we use in the brain. But unless you're on drugs that stop the breakdown of those sorts of chemicals, they're normally handled really well outside of the brain and don't get anywhere near your brain. So I think that one's probably a myth as well. So I think the likelihood is it's probably sort of confirmation bias. People say, oh, I ate some spicy food and it gave me loads of vivid dreams, but they forget that all the other times in the week they'd had vivid dreams as well and hadn't had spicy food. And so it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I'm sceptical that it's real.
Thank you, Dr. Chris. And we have Denise also with a question. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning. Doctor, could you explain quantum healing to me?
In a word, Denise, no. I don't know what it is. I've never heard of that. It sounds to me like someone trying to sell you something and make money out of the fact that people don't actually know what they're talking about. Quantum means something very, very small. And when we talk about quantum mechanics, we're talking about physics down at the level of individual atoms and smaller. And when you get down to those sorts of length scales, the normal rules of physics break down and things start to behave strangely, which is why we have quantum weirdness and spooky action at a distance and that kind of thing. But when it comes to healing, Yes, maybe we're in the business as doctors of doing molecular engineering, coming up with molecules that are tailor-made to do certain jobs in the body because we know what those molecules are trying to treat. So we can engineer atoms to give us things that are the right sort of size. But the word quantum means something very specific in a very specific sector of science. I haven't heard it applied in medicine meaningfully, apart from in people who are in the business of selling snake oil. So I'd be very cautious about anything anyone says to you in that realm, unless they can support it with good quality evidence that what they're telling you is true.
So we have one last question and caller we're going to squeeze in. Hi, good morning.
Morning, Chris. Morning, Chris. I'm curious, what causes insomnia?
Right. Well, insomnia is when you can't go to sleep. And there's a whole range of reasons why people don't go to sleep. And they range from very rare genetic conditions, including one called fatal familial insomnia, where people inherit a genetic trait that causes them not to be able to sleep properly, through to stresses, strains and worries. That's the most common reason, emotional reasons for insomnia. People worry and they can't get to sleep because they're worried or depressed or anxious about things. And because you don't sleep, you then don't function properly the next day, and your ability to have good judgment is impaired because you haven't slept, and that makes you even more worried, which makes you even less likely to sleep. So it's a negative feedback, or it's a vicious cycle. That's a very common thing. And then there are people who seem to have a trait where they're prone to insomnia. It doesn't cause them long-term health harms, but they don't sleep normally. And this may be because they have genes that work slightly differently in the way their body clock tells them when to wake up and when to go to sleep. Scientists are studying those people. They're rare in the population, but they certainly exist.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chris. It's always a pleasure to be in conversation with you. I'm always learning new things. We have lots of other questions, but unfortunately, we're not going to get through to it this morning. And enjoy the summer and the vitamin D in Cambridge, Dr.
I'll
Chris.
Do that. Thanks, Crystal. Have a good day. Even though you made Oxford references, I'll let you off.
Thank you so much.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.